Hey, Sal.
Hank, what's going on? We haven't worked a case in years.
I just bought my car at Carvana, and it was so easy. Too easy.
Think something's up?
You tell me. They got thousands of options.
Mm-hmm.
Found a great car at a great price.
Uh-huh.
And it got delivered the next day.
It sounds like Carvana just makes it easy to buy your car, Hank.
Yeah, you're right. Case closed.
Buy your car today on Carvana. Delivery fees may apply.
Hey, this is DeRay, and welcome to Posse of the People. In this episode, it's me and Miles talking about the news that you probably didn't hear with regard to race, justice, and equity from the past week. And then we highlight one more author from our 2025 Blackest Book Club reading list in collaboration with Reconstruction and Campaign Zero. And then Kaya sits down with the one and only Michael Harriet to talk about his book, Black AF History, The Unwhitewashed Story of America. Download the full Blackest Book Club reading list today. Here we go. As Black History Month comes to a close, Vote Save America is continuing its commitment to progress by supporting Black-led organizations and candidates of color through our Anxiety Relief Program. One candidate is Kimberly Pope Adams. She's running for a Virginia State House seat this year, a critical opportunity to expand the Democrats' slim one-seat majority. Your recurring donation in any amount helps build progressive power for 2025 and beyond. Join us and make an impact at votesaveamerica.com/donate. Pay for by Vote Save America. VoteSaveAmerica.com, not endorsed by any candidate or candidates committee. Hey everybody, we are excited to be back. Unfortunately, this is another big week of wild things happening in the federal government, but there are some other good things happening in the world. It is me and Miles today, but you will hear Kaya because she has an incredible interview coming up after the news. But this is DeRay at DeRay Wild on Twitter.
This is Miles E. Johnson at Feral Rapture on Instagram.
So Miles, let's just jump right into it. It's been a lot going on. I almost don't want to start with the Trump stuff.
I feel like it's been a really slow news week. Like nothing going on. It's just
no,
been slow.
No, they the CIA's purging people.
That was sarcasm. That was
okay, I'm like, Miles, what world are you in?
I'm sorry. You just got off a long flight. So I that was sarcasm, sarcasm, sarcasm.
Okay, let's start with the Kennedy Center. So if you did not see, Donald Trump has made himself the chair of the Kennedy Center board. He also purged some people off the board. We know that Shonda Rhimes, she resigned. Issa Rae would not have her show be there. And recently, the Kennedy Center has announced that they are experiencing a 50% drop in tickets after Trump appointed himself. And it's like, you know what? People shouldn't go back there. But it just all seems like one big mockery of just everything. Art, culture, the Black History Month thing at the White House just seem like a farce too. Kodak Black is the White House, official White House is posting Kodak Black looking out the window and making faces. And you're just like, what is going on?
Yeah. If we're being honest, I found the Obama era stuff just as much as a farce. I found that just as strange to see these.
Not just as strange. Not just.
So I found it just as strange.
Oh, okay.
No. I found it just as strange. And more than just as strange, just as manufactured. That was kind of like my first. It was the Obama stuff where I first started recognizing how people were going to the White House, because it wasn't really cool to go to the, or let me put it this way, it wasn't in the realm of cool in my world to go to the White House and like that be aspirational. But it was during the Obama era where I saw more people wanting to go to the White House. Friends, as I kind of went into different spaces, friends wanted to go to the White House, but then also celebrities and artists wanted to be associated with the president, where that just was not cool during the Bush era, which is my coming of age era. So, but looking at it and then seeing people and rappers who I know had deeply political eras and deeply anti-colonial eras, or people who were pro-gay and Obama was, you know, anti-gay for a lot of his tenure, specifically when he was trying to get elected, wanting proximity towards it. It felt just, that was when I first noticed, oh, this White House stuff is public performance, and I never considered it that way.
But what about the Kennedy Center stuff?
Yeah, I don't think I care about the Kennedy Center stuff. I think what I'm most concerned about is how this stuff and how the DEI stuff is used to capture our attention on things that don't necessarily affect your average Black person. So what I'm noticing is like a pattern to maybe use celebrities or public artists or public moments to disrespect Black people, to agitate Black people, where it doesn't matter what Shonda Rhimes or Issa Rae is or is not doing to the average Black person. And I think that these moments are kind of used to get us kind of riled up. And that's the thing that I'm hoping that more people wake up to, is that, you know, as hard as it might be to maybe elevate the conversation or evade certain conversations because they're poking at you, that certain conversations are designed to poke at you. Because if you're talking about the Kennedy Center thing, then you're not talking about maybe the higher risk things that Trump is doing. So that's how I've been pacing myself.
I don't know. I didn't think you'd say that, only because you have made the point before on the podcast many times that that sometimes we do a disservice to the overall work by not understanding the relevance that culture has in manufacturing political conditions, right? So when I think about the Kennedy Center, I'm actually interested in what happens when, like, you know, culturally, we will just wipe out anything that is not white art from major venues. Kodak Black on the Instagram of the White House feels like distraction to me. But all of a sudden, making something like the Kennedy Center Honors, or making the Kennedy Center, which is such a big venue, like...
Two separate things. I do not care about the Kennedy Center. I do not care about the Kennedy Center Honors. I don't agree with hierarchical evaluations of art or of culture. And I think that that has been a thing that has, like, gutted the integrity of Black art in America. So I abolish it all, if I'm being honest with you. But the thing that I was kind of coming into was me speaking as somebody who's here on what's today's date, February 23rd, 2025. So my tactic this week, it probably is different than what it would have been, let's say, in October. What I'm saying now is there's so much coming at us all at once. And then if we're talking about DEI, and then we're talking about Kodak Black, and then we're talking about the Kennedy Honors, what ends up happening, then we're talking about Tiger Woods, what ends up happening is that we're always kind of talking about these different things that kind of agitate us because of our parasocial relationship with celebrity and with culture and with art, which is beautiful. But right now we have other, it just feels like that may not be the best use of our attention, our focus right now, because there's so many things coming at us at once. I wish that we were in a space where that could be the whole conversation, but we just aren't.
What are the big things to you? Is it the firings?
I think the firing is the big thing for me, because I think so many Black people have federal jobs, and also so many Black people who are in the middle class are having federal jobs. And depending on how this all goes, you're going to start seeing even more Black people who maybe were that paycheck or that year away from their own financial ruin. That's going to start actualizing. So you're going to see Black people. We're already, as Black people, in a growing poverty. There's a growing poverty class in Black America, period. There's a stat that shows that Black people uniquely, if you were born out of poverty or middle class or upper middle class as a Black person, you're more likely to return to poverty class in your lifetime as a Black person. So we're going to be seeing that. So that scares me. But then, yeah, then the real economic things, I'm just kind of waiting and seeing about the real economic things of, as far as Medicare, food stamps. These are things that Social Security. These are the things that I'm waiting to see how it comes out in the wash. The other thing that I'm waiting to see, because that $5,000 comment or that thing, Trump and Elon hinted at there being some type of $5,000 refund to the taxpaying American for all the things that they cut from DOGE. So DOGE went in and slashed all these programs, and now that gave so much surplus of money that they're going to be able to give $5,000 to each American. And everybody says you can't do that. And I'm sure people who are the same economists who are trying to talk to the American people to not get Trump voted are saying that he can't do that. But Trump just doesn't seem to be somebody who where that works on. So and if you're plugged into this many billionaires and Elon, then it's like, I think you could ask for some favors specifically if that is to pacify a public whose rights and systems are being, you know, gutted, and you get them $5,000. That's what worked with COVID is that. So if Trump has a chance to give even more poor people $5,000 with his name on it, like that scares me.
Do you think that it'll, you know, I heard that too. I don't know how long this lasts. And a part of me, the 5K, I think would be a thing, but I just don't think it'll come out in the wash in the sense of like 5K and you being unemployed, homeless, and no health care won't feel like anything for very long. And even the layoffs or the firings in the federal government felt pretty distant to me until I know some people in my life who suddenly are unemployed. And like, you know, they were just a couple of paychecks away, and now they're trying to figure out what they're going to do. And a 5K check will do not a thing for them if they have to move. You know, like it is, I'm interested to see what happens with the aggregate of all these pretty wild decisions. And I'll tell you, I just flew back from London. And I'm on a plane. I'm like not nervous to fly there. I'm like the London people, they feel their FAA is fine. I'm nervous to come back. I'm just like, goodness gracious, you are still literally laying off FAA workers. And I just don't know. And granted, they're not flying commercial, so they don't care. But a part of me doesn't know how long the teardown strategy lasts. Like at a point you will fire, like this will start. People will start feeling this in a really personal way soon enough, in a way that poor people are feeling. You know, Head Start money has been frozen. The food pantry money has been frozen. So like people are feeling it in some ways, but I just don't know how long this lasts. They didn't realize it was tax season and laid off 6,000 IRS people. I'm like, what this feels like is going to happen is that they're going to make a crazy deficit, like an insane deficit, and then leave. And whoever comes next, it's going to be a nightmare if there is a next.
Yeah. Yeah. Perhaps. I'm just a little bit more cynical about their plans. I'm really cynical about Trump's election, the legitimacy of it. I'm cynical about there being any. I'm cynical about somebody being able to go through all of our data and who had access to our voting mechanisms. And now we do have somebody who can just decide what he wants. So if you can manufacture consent through technology, you know, then it's like you could do whatever you want to do, and people can yell as long as they want to and as loud as they want to. But what are you going to do specifically if you can turn, you know, 1,000 votes into 1,000,000? If it's your prerogative, so.
Is there a voice on the left that you are like a political leader that you're like, wow, you really are standing up to him?
Who's living?
Standing up to Trump, yeah. Or is that even a thing? Like, is that what you expect of the politicians, to challenge him or to, I don't know. Oh, did you see the exchange with the governor of Maine?
The NCAA has complied immediately, by the way. That's good. But I understand Maine. Is the Maine here, the governor of Maine?
Down here.
Are you not going to comply with it?
I'm complying with state and federal laws.
We are the federal law. Well, you better do it. You better do it because you're not going to get any federal funding at all if you don't. And by the way, your population, even though it's somewhat liberal, although I did very well there, your population doesn't want men playing in women's sports. So you better comply because otherwise you're not getting any federal funding.
See you in court.
Every state. Good. I'll see you in court. I look forward to that. That should be a real easy one. And enjoy your life after governor, because I don't think you'll be in elected politics.
And I think maybe the last episode I was kind of pushed on this too, around me just feeling this feeling of kind of political depression, specifically among Black folks and poor Black folks, younger Black folks, and just the people I've been in community with and people I'm not been in community with, random talks. And I felt kind of legitimized when I saw a whole lot of articles come out, talk about the lack of Black people at these protests. And I think I see so much of this pushback on Trump that's public from all people, not just the governor of Maine, but a lot of different people, as so little, so late, and it just doesn't move me. And it's hard, and if you told me this came from 2017, I wouldn't know. If it came from yesterday, I wouldn't know. So I think that Palestine was a leading reason why people didn't show up to these to vote. And I think that all this other stuff that's going around and all this other stuff that is being shown to kind of to attract people into more of an emotional response is just empty.
Hey, you're listening to Pod Save the People. Stay tuned, there's more to come. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. Now, what are some of the relationship green flags? You hear a lot about red flags and things that you should avoid, but we don't talk enough about what are the green flags in friendships and partners, just generally in relationships. And if you're not sure what they look like, that's how therapy can actually be helpful too, in talking things out and being like, what are you trying to attract in your life? What do you want to be around? We got to talk about that stuff too. What kind of green flags do I hope people experience when they meet me? Whether you're dating, married, building a friendship, or just working on yourself, it's time to be more intentional about the relationships that you build. Now, therapy has been a game changer for me. It's been so powerful to have somebody not in my day-to-day life that I can talk to and process things with, and I would recommend it for you too. And that's where BetterHelp comes in. BetterHelp is fully online and makes therapy affordable and convenient and serves over 5 million people worldwide. And you get to access a diverse network of more than 30,000 credentialed therapists with a wide range of specialties, and you can easily switch therapists anytime at no extra cost. Discover your relationship green flags with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/people to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/people.
Hey, Sal.
Hank, what's going on? We haven't worked a case in years.
I just bought my car at Carvana, and it was so easy. Too easy.
Think something's up?
You tell me. They got thousands of options.
Mm-hmm.
Found a great car at a great price.
Uh-huh.
And it got delivered the next day.
It sounds like Carvana just makes it easy to buy your car, Hank.
Yeah, you're right. Case closed.
Buy your car today on Carvana. Delivery fees may apply.
So something I do deeply care about, which is healthcare and Luigi. Did you see the tweet, DeRay, that says Luigi's lawyer says she was learning about his case from an HBO documentary because the police won't share the evidence they claim to have, but they're sharing it on HBO. They're working to make sure he doesn't get a fair trial, and I feel like the focus should be more on this than his look. So this was a response to somebody posting a gorgeous headshot of Luigi. But one of the things the lawyer revealed is that they have all this evidence, but HBO has this and they don't, which is showing that, they're trying to sway public attention. How do you feel about that? And I don't know. Do you think that this story is going to be able to even swim with the current news cycle and how like the news is right now.
Oh, that it comes back. You know, I think that they really overplayed their hand. I think they thought he was going to be like this scoundrel and people would be like cold-blooded murderer, and then that didn't happen. And I think there's no way he gets convicted. Like, I think that they're going to try and work every angle to force him into a plea deal. Like, that is what this seems like. Like, that's why you withhold the information to be like, I got it. The moment we show the jury, they're going to convict you. Like, I just don't think this is going to trial. I think there's no way he gets convicted at trial. That's what I'm trying to say.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm just like curious about what it means.
you don't think it'll get in the air in the, like, you, like the government stuff is too crazy that this just won't cut again.
I don't think so. I'm hoping not. My gut is saying that, you know, once everything gets its motion, people will start caring. My bigger hope that might just be fantasy is that Luigi is really good. Luigi and Luigi's lawyers are really good at articulating concerns. So I have to be honest with you. I was looking for a courtroom fantasy. So I did want to see Luigi talk, articulate frustrations about healthcare and about billionaire money, and even the donation for $30,000 that went viral, which was from a person who deemed themselves to be independently wealthy. Understood the energy around Luigi. Let's just say that, and. I really am excited about that because I've just been hungry to see a conversation around class that feels deep enough, and this feels deep enough because it is wrapped up in that crime, and it felt like it was keeping people's attention, and it feels like nothing else specifically in the last 10 years has really captured people around class, and this felt like a silver bullet. So I'm like, ugh, I don't want it to just float away.
And it was like all races, all, like, it wasn't like, you know, it was like he very quickly became sort of somebody that people across coalition lines that don't normally all reach the same conclusion. People were like, yeah, this doesn't really make a lot of sense. Did you see, I was literally at dinner yesterday when I got the alert on my phone about Joy Reid's show being canceled. And I was frankly really surprised because, you know, she's been on MSNBC for a long time. She's had a solid show. It's a consistent listener base. It might not be as high as some other shows, but to suggest that Joy's not like a real presence on MSNBC would just be untrue. And people have a lot of theories about it. There's some organizing happening to put pressure on MSNBC. And as you know, Rashida, who was the president of MSNBC, Black woman, she stepped down. There's a new guy at MSNBC. So they're replacing, I don't know if you saw this, they're replacing her show, which is a 7 o'clock spot, with the panel show that now is on the weekends with Simone, Michael Steele, and Alicia Menendez. Jen Psaki looks like she's getting a new time slot. As you know, Maddow's back. And Chris Hayes' show, I think Chris still has his show, and Ari Melber still has a show. But I was surprised that Sharpton still has a show, that Joy will be off air. What did you think of that?
Yeah, I feel like I wasn't as much as a regular MSNBC watcher. So I think seeing the trends for legacy media, The news on its face didn't surprise me. I was like, yeah, and I'm sure 10,000 other people about to come down the pipeline who getting fired too, you know, and I'm sure they're shrinking. They're continuously shrinking until everybody will eventually get fired. But then, thankfully, because of the news and because I knew you were going to bring this up, I kind of went into my own little research rabbit hole, because the last person who really capture my attention who was associated with MSNBC was Melissa H. Perry. And I liked the talk that she had with Bell Hooks. And during in that talk, right before she had got fired, she speaks about how the only reason she's able to articulate these things on television is because a white man said that she couldn't articulate these things. And I didn't realize that Joy Reid was her like direct replacement after she got fired. So I thought that was really interesting. In other times where, again, that kind of era of, you know, an age group of black people, she had her own homophobia that came to light as well. That was my other interaction with Joy Reid and her work. With saying all that, I was like, but what was it? Because I was like, it's not the homophobia. It was not. I was looking at what she was saying, and I was like, I don't really think it's the anti-Trump stuff. I really don't. And then I see that she was one of the very few people to call what was happening in Palestine a genocide. She was one of the very few people to articulate what was happening in Gaza as wrong. And I think that we would be missing the whole point if we don't see the connective tissue, no matter how you feel about these individual people. But Amanda Seales had Zionists come to her show and say she couldn't do it in Philadelphia and got her show canceled. Breonna Joy Gray has articulated that what got her fired from The Hill was Zionism. And now we see this black woman who was on television speaking truth to power about what's happening in Palestine, and we see her erased too. So I do think there's a pattern here. And just to be clear, the only reason I brought up her homophobia in this scenario was because I was trying to search for like what was the thing that pushed her out outside of like, let's say, Simone or something, because I just don't know. And that's why I wanted to bring that up. But I think everybody can like grow and move beyond certain ideas and stuff like that. But I just had to be honest about what I was finding. So those are my first looks. And I think us not naming that, it's a little bit dangerous too, like not naming the pattern. And I think seeing that pattern of Zionism and speaking out against Zionism and for Palestinian folks is leading to people's erasure from the media. I think that is an important pattern to articulate too, and to see and to see happening, because it's not just opinionated black women leaves for no reason.
They didn't give any official reasons, but I think about like Don losing his show. I think about Joy losing her show. I'll be interested to see what she does next. And, you know, like, who is black on news? It's like Abby is on CNN. Simone is on MSNBC. I literally don't know who's on Fox, so I don't know if there's a black person on the Fox network at all. Sharpton is on MSNBC. Is there anybody else? Hey, you're listening to Pod Save the People. Stay tuned, there's more to come. Pod Save the People is brought to you by ZBiotics Sugar to Fiber. Okay, now if you follow me online, you probably know that I have been heavily into the gym recently. It's been a place for me to just get my mind right and just be in a good, healthy space. And in that journey, I've been trying to figure out the things that I need to take or drink or eat to be the healthiest. And that's where ZBiotics Sugar to Fiber comes in, is that I realize that I don't get enough fiber. I realized too that like no diet is like perfectly balanced, that, you know, either I feel like I'm eating too much or not enough. And that's actually where the Sugar to Fiber probiotic mix came in. And now it's a part of my daily routine. Being really conscious of the food you eat, sometimes it gets stressful, and I don't want to be stressed when I think about what to eat. And here's the thing, extra sugar is found in so many foods, and that's why the sugar to fiber mix is really helpful, because it helps me actually get to the fiber intake that I need to take every day. Now, here's the thing. The PhD microbiologist over at ZBiotics understood that extra sugar is all but impossible to avoid these days, and 95% of Americans don't get enough fiber. I am in that 95%. So they genetically engineered a probiotic to convert some extra sugar from our everyday diet into a prebiotic fiber called lebbin. And this leads to a more balanced microbiome, which is a key to a healthy gut. one stick pack of sugar to fiber, and you get a daily dose of fiber from the foods you already eat. That's what's so great about this is that here's my routine. When I have lunch, I get some water, get some sugar to fiber. It works every day. It is simple, tastes good, and I don't really need to change anything about my diet. I like to know where my fiber is coming from, and because it is converting that extra sugar to fiber, I got it. It has allowed me to not stress out over making sure that I have the appropriate fiber intake in a given day. And it's simple. In 2025, I'm prioritizing my health and my microbiome. Sugar to fiber is my daily insurance that I'm getting enough fiber. Go to zbiotics.com/PSTP and use PSTP at checkout for 15% off any first-time orders of Zbiotics probiotics. Zbiotics has a 100% money-back guarantee, so if you're unsatisfied for any reason, they'll refund you your money, no questions asked. Thank you, Zbiotics, for sponsoring this episode.
What I am curious about, too, is how the pundit class does in independent media. And then I'm also just interested in, I just think that Black people on the left's political voice have been gutted. And I think that people who participated in being a part of this kind of like pundit class of people who slowly but surely a lot of their rhetoric became centered around Trump or centered around their own kind of like Democratic Party interests have lost a lot of the sway they're going to have with other Black people. So I'm hopeful. But I'm also realistic because I'm trying to see like where it's just it would just be interesting to see where Joyen Reid, who's not Don Lemon in a lot of ways, where she lands. Specifically, I'm thinking in 1 or 2 years. I'm sure the response to her immediately will be great and it will be big. But I'm fearful that her dedicating so much time to something that I feel like a lot of Black people were beginning to ignore or tune out. It has kind of left her with not a whole lot of huge standing with the greater Black community, who I'm kind of like consistently worried about, concerned about.
I'm always reminded too that you know she came up through blogs. She was like an OG. Like I think she was.
Yeah, that's
the
where
griot.
The homophobia was. Yeah.
Wasn't she the griot? She was the griot.
The homophobia was on her personal website, not on the griot. I don't know where okay. She was.
Yeah, she came up from one of those, like she was a blogger. So maybe she'll go back to blogging, but it is, I am worried about the lack of Black voices on network television, even if it is not the thing that is driving most conversation. I do think voters are watching it. And that is, now we need to figure out how to get a set of people who are not voting to vote, and they are not watching MSNBC. But the set of people, I think, who are voting consistently are watching it, which is why it does matter. But let's go to the news. So my news is about the police, just because I don't want people to... There is so much wild stuff happening with the federal government that I worry that people are losing sight of some of the local things that are happening that are actually, you know, important. And remember that there are 19,000 police departments. Most people know ICE right now because of what Trump is doing, but most of the regular police departments are in communities. They are cities and towns and states. So this is about a small town in Alabama that is the Hanceville police chief. Jason and four officers, they were indicted by a grand jury. And the entire police department is suspended for a moment because of the indictment. So a couple of things came out, but it looks like they just were letting anybody go into the evidence room, that there was rampant corruption. Hinsville only has 3,200 people, and it's 45 miles north of Birmingham. But they had pictures of a hole in the wall and a broomstick that was used to open the door to the evidence room, and people could literally just do whatever they want. One of the things that the grand jury found was that their negligence led to a 2024 death of a dispatcher who overdosed at work. I don't even know. You're like, the logistics of that is wild. That's just nuts. And that the police were selling drugs. That is the short version of what was going on. And I have to imagine they were probably using drugs too, but they were selling them out of the evidence room. And it looks like they have been temporarily disbanded, which is a good thing. And by disbanded, they're on administrative leave. And we need more of this. Now, the only thing that we got to be careful about is that we've seen this happen before. And then when a local, like a town police department gets disbanded, what normally happens is a sheriff's department takes over or like some other, and they normally are they're not great either. So, so that's not a good thing. But we so rarely see accountability for police in this way. And I'm actually happy that the grand jury was, and the prosecutor allowed it because the prosecutor has to convene the grand jury. Was like, I want y'all to see this and tell me what you think. And they were like, it's not enough just to fire or indict these five people, six people, disband the department.
That news read so wild to me. I was like trying to make sure I was understanding specifically the finding of the man, OD'd. I'm like, am I reading this correctly? That like, this is what was happening.
So nuts.
It's weird because I'm a truly empathetic, compassionate person. so part of me is always like the police are corrupt, right? And corruption lives inside of the police because the police system is built on corruption. That is just something that I believe. The twist in this story that twisted my heart in a way I didn't think it was going to was the addiction piece. And it was the opioid crisis of it all. Me seeing the pictures of the people. Again, there's nothing in me that's saying, oh, these people are good people or these people are people who don't deserve it. But I think it complicated the pursuit of power and the sustaining of power through police force when I added addiction to it. When I think that, these people are not only maybe bent towards racism, right, or violent racism, but also that's being fueled by drug use, that's being fueled by addiction. This just laid it out in a way that felt undeniable. In other times, it's kind of always hinted at or maybe suggested, but this was clear that I don't know. These are the same people who are judging what to do in a moment's notice when something's happening. That scared me.
And now the dispatcher, you're like, we need the dispatchers to be on it, not using drugs during dispatch. I was like, well, that is just dangerous for everybody.
And when we think about the police, you know, I'm not a square when it comes to drug or alcohol use. But if there was a industry where I'm like, no, don't even hit a joint. Like, we literally need you clear.
Yeah,
it's the police
and all the employees inside. You're like, not the dispatch. Could you imagine calling 911? And the dispatcher is high, you're like, well, that's not helpful. You know what I mean? You're like in a crisis. It's like, that is nuts. So that was my news.
I wanted just to use my time to talk about and think about Valletta Wallace. She passed away. She is the mother of the greatest rapper, one of the greatest rappers, depending on who you are and what coast you are usually, Notorious B.I.G. And I think how I've been reflecting on Valletta Wallace since she's passed is, okay, first thing is how spooky is it that she passes? And then, like, I think within 2 hours, I don't know which came first, this or the egg, but Diddy's lawyer drops everything and says, I can't do this case anymore with Diddy. Like, whatever's happening in Diddy's file is so nasty and so unwinnable that his lawyer said, I gotta go, allegedly. So I thought that was interesting.
And that lawyer represented Osama bin Laden.
Think okay. So I thought it was just one of those spooky synchronistic moments that Valletta Wallace had passed around that announcement. But beyond that, when I thought about Notorious B.I.G., I thought about how she has been such a good steward to his legacy. And if I'm being honest with you, as somebody who is obsessed with Notorious B.I.G., me and my boyfriend met on the anniversary, March 9th of Notorious B.I.G.'s death. We have posters of Notorious B.I.G. Like, my sister's a huge Notorious B.I.G. fan. And if I'm being honest, it was post his death that he was able to sit in our imaginations as something, to me, more prominent and more dignified than when he was living. And I think that has so much to do with Valletta Wallace. And I think how she has kept him inside of our imaginations, and how she's helped with keep those things inside of our imaginations has been really, really, really good. And I think it's something when you're known because of something bad happening to your son, you know? And just even right before she passed away, she was saying how, like, she wants to slap Diddy. Like, she would, like, you know, like she was always commentating. She was always being a good steward to her son's legacy. And she also, there's been just a few times where she's commented on the state of hip hop culture or things that were happening that maybe we want to hear from the perspective of somebody who was related to Notorious B.I.G. And she's really always been really, really sharp with it. And I think she's done such a beautiful job at honoring his legacy. And I think that's really good work. And I think that's oftentimes feminized work, or work that's usually donned on women. And I just wanted to talk about it because she is somebody, for better or for worse, who made her whole entire public life about her son. And I think that is usually work given to women. And I just wanted to honor that she did such a great job. And I think even, I get the numbers wrong, but there was some... There was $1 million. I don't know how. I think $2 million was his value, in air quotes, on death. And now he has a multi-million dollar legacy and estate that he's, like, leaving behind. And that is also because of those good financial decisions. So not just a cultural steward, but also a financial and economic one. So I wanted just to bring her her flowers and say thank you to ancestor Valletta Wallace.
Thanks for bringing this up. I didn't know she was a preschool teacher. That made me smile. And when I see pictures of her, I'm like, I could see you. You are that, like, Black woman in the neighborhood who, like, raised five generations of kids at that 3 to 4 year old age. And she was 78. She lived a good life. She lived a long life. And Biggie has two kids. And hopefully they are well taken care of with his estate. And, you know, I remember that moment where Miss Wallace and Tupac's mom did that joint. They did that joint thing at the award show. Mm-hmm. Remember that? They did that. So, like, that.
Yeah, at the MTV Music Awards.
Yeah. And you're right. She did say she wanted to slap it. I'm like, you give Black mom vibes up to the end. So I really appreciate that. You know, this makes me think, too, of, like, just a generation of people that I don't know if younger kids know, but, like, you know, you think about, I don't know if you saw the Wayans family get awarded at the NAACP Awards. Mm-hmm. But as you think about, like, that In Living Color era, that whole, like, time period of people are getting older and what will happen when that art and the people who made that art goes away. I'm really, I don't know. I've been thinking about that a lot, especially when, like, Irv Gotti died, like, and he was awful to Ashanti. So that is not great.
Well, not just Ashanti.
That's all. I only know the Ashanti stuff. He was awful to more people.
Irv Gotti?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I just bring him up because he was so young. He died so young. You know, he was 50 something.
Yeah, and I think that he was just on record talking about, like, it, just having diabetes and then not taking care of himself and being drinking really hard and living really hard and kind of having that ethos. So I watched too many Dame Dash and Irv Gotti interviews. So just hearing how they talked about their lifestyles, it wasn't that much of a shocker because I was deep in with Irv Gotti.
Do you think that's indicative of that whole moment? Like, do you think they're outliers or that was the moment?
Oh, like the lifestyle choices? Yeah, I think that's definitely the moment. I think that's still the moment when you look at the rappers who, I mean, Future is our biggest rapper. If you listen to what Drake is doing, like, I think that a lot of, when it comes to addiction and this living, Drake, you only live once, you know what I mean? Like, YOLO, like, that is, has been such a huge part of hip-hop culture, specifically when it met glamour. A member of Roxanne Shanté said something about hip-hop and glamour and hip-hop fabulousness and said, well, that really comes from the fact that we never save for a rainy day, so we just spend on a really, really nice umbrella. Like, that idea that we don't necessarily aren't steering our own future, so let's just spend and be in hedonistic decadence today. So I think that still is very much so alive, just with worse talent. I think that's the trade-off.
Okay, there we go. Got it.
Don't go anywhere. More Pod Save the People's coming. This podcast is sponsored by Squarespace. Now, Squarespace is the all-in-one website platform for entrepreneurs to stand out and succeed online. Whether you're just getting started or you're managing a growing brand, Squarespace makes it easy to create beautiful websites, engage your audience, and sell anything from products to content to time, all in one place, all on your terms. And now there's design intelligence from Squarespace, which combines two decades of industry-leading design expertise with cutting-edge AI technology to unlock your strongest creative potential. Design intelligence also empowers anybody to build a beautiful, more personalized website tailored to your unique needs and can help you craft a bespoke digital identity to use across your online presence anywhere. And Squarespace Payments is the easiest way to manage your payments in one place with Squarespace. The onboarding is fast and simple, and you can get started in just a few clicks and start receiving payments right away. Plus, give your customers more ways to pay with popular payment methods like Klarna, ACH Direct Debit, Apple Pay, Afterpay, and Clearpay. And it allows you to connect all your accounts in a few clicks, your social accounts, multimedia accounts, and you can connect them as icons, direct links, or embedded feeds. And you can build visitor trust while updating content only when you need it, and it allows you to extend your brand's footprint. And the cool thing is that sellers can also sync their product catalog directly with Instagram, Facebook, YouTube, and Google to reach more people. Head to squarespace.com for a free trial, and when you're ready to launch, go to squarespace.com/PSTP to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. That's squarespace.com/PSTP.
Hello, Pod Save the People family. It's Kaya, and I am so excited about our guest today. We have Michael Harriott with us. Michael Harriott is an award-winning journalist, best-selling author, celebrated poet, and public historian who's hailed as one of the most eloquent writers in America. His New York Times bestseller, Black AF History, The Unwhitewashed Story of America, is required reading in at least 10 universities, and numerous colleges have adopted his Race as an Economic Construct curriculum, which examines social structures using history data and the laws of supply and demand. Michael Harriott, you might know him from the Griot, you might know him from the Root. He influences everything from presidential politics to pop culture. He originated the phrase invited to the cookout. He is widely considered to be the dean of Black Twitter and the Negro Explainer. He and Pharrell created the award-winning Drapedomaniacs Unshackled History podcast. And his newest project is called Contraband Camp. We're going to get into that in a few minutes. But Michael Harriott, thank you so much for coming on Pod Save the People.
Thank you for having me.
We are excited. So we're here because every February we do a feature called the Blackest Book Club, where the four co-hosts of the podcast pick books in response to a few questions that we want to share with our listeners. And this year, Black AF History was the book that I chose to respond to the question, what book taught me something surprising about Black history and Black culture? And Michael, what you should know about me is I am a longtime educator who previously ran the public school system in Washington, D.C., and then left to start a curriculum and technology company teaching Black history and Black culture to young people. So I know a lot about Black history, but when I read this book, it changed my life. And so that's why we're excited to have you on the podcast. We are going to jump right in. And let me ask you, why'd you write this book?
Oh, it was first, it was not my intent to write it. So I used to teach a course called Race as an Economic Construct that examined our race and culture in America through the lens of economics. And I was going to write a book about it. And every publisher that I went to was like, yeah, we love the proposal. But what about that history thing you do on Twitter? So the one book deal became a two book deal, and so when I proposed the name of the book, they said, "Well, you know, it was before you know people were really coming at Black history and all this stuff," and they said, the people at the publishing company said, "I don't think people would be interested in this obscure subject that you're talking about called critical race theory," because the title of my book was White Peopleology Toward a More Critical Race Theory. And no one was talking about critical race theory then. And so they said, well, why not do the history book first? And so that's how Black AF History came to be.
Okay. And who's your intended audience?
Black people. I think that we read books and we have books that talk about in the history of Black people from a Black perspective. And we have books, of course, that talk about America from a white perspective. But I wanted to do a book that talks about the idea of whiteness and the idea of America from a Black perspective and the history of that, the history of whiteness in America from a Black perspective. And so I wanted to talk to people, Black people, about it, because that's always my intended audience. And, you know, I look at it as if you ever been in a room and like you feel your feet getting cold or you hear a sound and nobody else feels it. And you wonder, like, am I crazy or do I feel a draft or do I hear something? And sometimes it feels like Black people are always feeling like, am I crazy? Do I feel this racism and nobody else is saying anything about it? That's how I write, right? To let Black audiences know that you ain't crazy. Like, this world is crazy. This country is crazy, not you.
That is absolutely, I mean, that is key to preserving our sanity, right? Because part of the thing about racism is it is supposed to drive you crazy, which will distract you and stop you from doing your work. But your writing style is not like a regular historian. So tell me, like, why you approach history in this particular way.
Well, like, when you're talking to Black people, which is what I intended to do, you know how we are, right? Like, we could be at a funeral, and if somebody's got on the wrong clothes or the wrong, why she wear that hat? Why she wore an Easter dress to my mama's funeral, right? We're going to make a joke about it, right?
Yeah.
Like, sometimes we laugh to keep from crying, and sometimes we laugh just to laugh. And that's how I've always written. You know, I think every writer develops a style, and I learned, like, I don't try to inject humor into anything. I don't feel the need to take it out or to avoid it because I'm talking about something serious. And that's how my style evolved.
But that's not how historians usually write. So somebody had to give you permission or make you feel like it was okay to write kind of the way we talk.
Well, I don't know if it's permission. I don't think I ever like sought permission, but I was homeschooled for the first part of my education. So the history I learned, part of the history I learned, was taught to me, you know, by Black people through word of mouth. And so when I, you know, it was only recently when I really started discovering, like, oh, that, like, Black people really believe this stuff that they tell them in school. I didn't realize, like, that people learn about, you know, George Washington and Thomas Jefferson being noble heroes. And then, like, later on in life, they learned that they were slave masters. I thought that's how you learned it. So, without, like, a lot of the times I never really had to undo the whitewashing.
I see. That homeschooling at the beginning is liberatory, right? Because you are not taught with the constructs that most other people are taught with. That explains a lot. Okay, so what's one of your favorite stories in the book?
I think everyone's favorite story in the book is Forrest Joe. Everybody loves Forrest Joe. Uh-huh. So if you're listening and haven't read the book, Forrest Joe was a man who unenslaved himself and basically wreaked havoc on Georgia and South Carolina in the early 1820s. And the result, you know, it's not just like an interesting character. Forrest Joe is the origin story of America's first police force. The first police force in America was created to catch this Black dude who was, you know, one of the favorite things about him is he went onto the governor's plantation and just started shooting at him and told him, like, if I see you in the streets, you know, we gonna have it. And so I think a lot of people love Forrest Joe and many of the stories that they hadn't been taught in, you know, classical American history, if you will.
Yeah, what do you think Forrest Joe means for people? Why do people love Forrest Joe so much?
Because I think that we think that, you know, a few years ago, that phrase started floating around, I'm not my ancestors. And I think that people think we conceded or capitulated to the oppression that we've always experienced and not that we fought. They thought, like, there was a period when the Black Panthers were fighting back, and that's about it. But the truth is, right, like, that has always been the way we survived and resisted. And so I think that is partly why. And I think that, like, the idea that we tended to our survival by scaring white folks is also interesting too.
I love that. I absolutely love that. One of the questions that we ask in the Blackest Book Club is, what book do you think every Black kid should read and why? And I want to ask you that about your stories. Besides Forrest Joe, if every Black kid in America could read one Michael Harriet story, either from the book or from one of your podcasts or whatever, what do you think is the most powerful story that we could share with African-American young people?
I think one of my favorite stories is the story of, and I talk about it a little in the book, but I've written about it elsewhere, is the story of Moses Dixon. Moses Dixon was a guy, he was a barber. He was formerly enslaved and was set himself free and traveled on riverboats, cutting hair throughout the South. And every state, and he eventually went to every state that had slavery and was planning a national slave revolt. And so one night he had basically organizers in every state that had slavery. They gathered in a room in St. Louis and swore that they would never stop until the slaves are free. And they formed what they call a group, basically what was a fraternity. And those knights, they call themselves knights. And those knights eventually didn't start their National Slave Revolt, because the Civil War had already started and most of the Knights actually joined the Union forces. But the fraternity continued, began accepting women, and they would give a penny a week. And that's what built the first Black hospital in Mound Bayou, Mississippi, where almost everybody you know from the civil rights movement was trained. Fannie Lou Hamer, even Jesse Jackson. And they hired a surgeon to work at that hospital, T.R.M. Howard. And because of T.R.M. Howard, he basically created his own police armed police force, and they protected the Black journalists who came to investigate the story of Emmett Till. And that's how we know what Emmett Till, what actually happened to Emmett Till, because, you know, 100 years earlier, a Black man tried to start a national slave revolt.
Huh. I love that. How do you know all of this stuff? Where are you getting this from?
When you pull threads, I always go down rabbit holes. Like when I hear something, I say, well, how did that happen? And then how did that happen? And then how did that happen? And eventually get to the bottom of the rabbit hole. So it's just natural curiosity and the natural desire to read things. I think that's where it comes from.
Why are we not more curious as a people? Like, we have such a fascinating history. You are helping to illuminate. And I find when I read these things, then I go down the rabbit hole as well. Why aren't more of our Black teachers curious in this way? Why aren't kids more motivated? Now we have information at our fingertips, right? So why aren't we motivated to figure out more of our own history, to tell our own story?
Because that natural curiosity is not even cultivated. As a matter of fact, it's probably suppressed, right? Because you can't teach critical thinking and natural curiosity and also teach some of the nonsense that we learn in school, right? Like, just not just in history, but in all subjects, whether it is like I before E except after C, but like, why C so special? And how about like words like heist? Like that doesn't. and you know, it extends to all. I remember when I was like a little kid, probably like 7 or 8 years old, and my mom used to teach Vacation Bible School, and they had like a math contest, and my sister won, but my mom, like, I went out of the contest at like the first round because I didn't know my multiplication tables. And my mom was like embarrassed that I didn't know my multiplication tables. It's like, you're going to learn your multiplication tables. And I was 8 years old, right? So she didn't teach me my multiplication tables. She just told me, you better learn them. Well, if you've never been taught your multiplication tables, you don't know that they end at 12, right? Like, you learn your multiplication tables. So when I started going to public school, we used to have this math test, a timed math test every week, right? And the time would increase, the time would decrease every week, but the number of questions would increase. And my teacher asked me, like, well, you don't show your work, so it doesn't count. And I was like, what work? Like, y'all don't know 14 times 18, right? And that's an example of, right, like, if you just allow students to explore their own curiosity and not put, like, these arbitrary limits on it, they will learn more, but they might, like, question you more, right? Like, I really just learned that people actually believed that George Washington had wooden teeth, right? I thought that was a thing, like the moon is made of cheese, right? Like, it was a joke. Like, people don't really believe that, right? I've learned that people actually believe that. No, that dude has slave teeth, right?
He has slave teeth, yes.
So I think the intent to suppress our natural curiosity is how they teach us, right? Because they don't want to teach us 12 times 18. They don't want to teach us the true history. They don't want to teach us phonics. So they teach us I before E except after C. They teach us 12 timetables. They teach us that George Washington had wooden teeth. Because a lot of times the teachers don't know. Right? The teachers got to carry the one when they're doing their timetables. The teachers never learn real Black history. The teachers don't know how to spell unless they look it up in a dictionary.
That is all very true. And I think one of the things that I've tried to do as an educator is not think about what are the skills that young people need to learn. But how do we create young people who are curious, young people who will challenge the status quo? Like, the purpose of school, in my estimation of things, and this is sort of why I started Reconstruction, I was like, well, wait a minute. All of my Jewish friends go to Hebrew school or Sunday school. All of my Korean friends go to Korean school. Why are we as Black people leaving it up to schools to teach our history and our culture? And what we know is when our young people have a strong identity, when they see themselves in the content that they are learning, not only does their academic progress soar, their confidence soars, their leadership soars, all kinds of positive indicators. And, you know, we tried to create a curriculum at DC Public Schools that was turning out problem solvers, advocates, community activists. We believe that we needed to prepare young people to solve their own problems, their community's problems, and the problems of the world. But that is not how most education systems are set up.
Right.
And we can talk about that for a long time. But what you just did, which is pull in your multiplication tables, George Washington's slave teeth, and whatever else we were just talking about to illustrate the point, I think is one of your superpowers. So talk to me a little bit about one of my favorite things, which are your threads on Facebook and Twitter, where you are telling a story about you and your sister growing up or about seemingly innocuous things. And then at the end, you tell us, no, that's not what this is really about.
I think, you know, as a person who kind of unknowingly was taught the art of storytelling growing up, that I think it's the easiest way to learn, right? It is, once you can contextualize things, you understand them better. And not only aren't we taught that way, we don't even kind of use that as a tool in our toolbox to explain things. Well, what happens is, like, if you don't know history because you don't know stories, then you might think Black people are lazy because you don't know about redlining and you don't know about segregation. You don't know, like, how schools work. So I think that I started using I think of it as adapting storytelling to anything, right? So if I'm on Twitter, I write differently than if I'm writing for a newspaper versus a book versus writing a book versus writing a script, right? But it's all a form of storytelling. And that I started doing it on Twitter to illustrate how things, like, not how things used to be, because to me, that's not what history is. It explains how things are right now and why it got to be that way. And, you know, because of the character limit, you can only go but so far with a story unless you, you know, make each. So to me, I look at each, you know, tweet as self-encapsulated in it itself. So somebody might tweet the third part of that thread and somebody might tweet the fifth tweet in that thread, right? So it has to make sense as a standalone tweet, but in context, it also tells a different story, because that's how the world is, right? Like, if you see somebody crying on a sidewalk, it seems like a sad woman. And then if you know the context of why she's crying and what happened before, it might tell a whole different story. And so I see the world through those lenses, right? Like we, you know, things are individual parts of time, but they are all connected to other things and other actions. And people are too, right? Right? Like what you do in DC will eventually affect me in some way, whether it's like a butterfly flapping its wings, you know, it'll eventually produce a wave that, you know, floods a city.
Mm-hmm. Talk to me a little bit about you and, at the time, Mayor Pete.
Yeah, like, so that started... Like I like people think like you're like Pete Buttigieg, and I was like, no, like Pete Buttigieg. So as a journalist, mm-hmm. Specifically writing for a black audience or to black people, one of the things that I've always done, like, and I think I just inherited this from my family, it's like correcting the record. Right? Especially as it relates to black people, right? If you say something about black people that is patently false or wrong or misguided, then I'm not mad at you. Let me just tell you how stupid this thing was that you said, right? So somebody sent me a clip of Pete Buttigieg when he was running for president, who said that, you know, what's wrong, or, you know, what black folks need, because, you know, I always hate that narrative of the things that black folks need. But what black folks need is more role models. Well, you know, I mean, anybody who knows black neighborhoods or grew up in a black neighborhood, no, like, because y'all segregated us. Right. We got black teachers in black neighborhoods and black lawyers and black doctors. Like, you know, like, yeah. Like, we're not confined by, like, socioeconomic factors. Like, if you poor and black, you know a black lawyer, you know a black doctor, because of what white people did. So when he said that, right, and this guy who went to Harvard, who has been the mayor of a town, like, you know you were in a room with them white people saying that because you know that's what them white people hear. That, I mean, that ain't even what he believes. So it wasn't that he was wrong. It's that he was lying and using black people in his lie to prove that he was some kind of benevolent merchant of equality for this country. And I didn't want, like, it wasn't that I was trying to tell black people that Pete Buttigieg was wrong. I was trying to tell black people that he was a lying motherfucker, because he was a motherfucker who was lying. And to his credit, he called me and said, his first words out of his mouth was, well, I've never been called a lying motherfucker before. And we had a conversation.
The title of your article was Pete Buttigieg is a lying MF, right?
Yes, right. That was the title.
Okay, and so he called you.
And those were the first words out of his mouth, was like, I've never been called a lying MF before. And I didn't have any animus or like yell at him or anything. I was just like, well, you know, like, if you're going to be president, if you're the mayor of a city, if you're in a room with people who make decisions, you can't, first of all, you can't perpetuate the lie that has already been used to destroy black people. Like the reason for that all these racial disparities exist is not because white people did anything. It's just that, like, we don't see no black people who can read, right? So, you know, that was always my point. Like, it had nothing to do with Pete Buttigieg as a person, but what he was doing, right? Yep.
And share with us the analogy that you used to help him understand what you were trying to say.
So, one of the things I talked about is that, right, I can't remember, I don't know which specific one you were talking about, because they were like actually two subsequent pieces. But I told the story of, I lived in a neighborhood that was that was segregated. My town was literally bisected into, and it was 50% black and 50% white. So when they killed the black, killed off the black high school and integrated the schools, it was on the white side of town. So I grew up in a town where black people literally had to jump a ditch to go to school. And so some of the black people built the bridge over the school, over the ditch. But, you know, kids would sometimes be, you know, pranksters and just remove the ditch. So just to watch people fall in, right? But my point was that the people who, when it was raining, didn't jump that ditch were not just, you know, not caring about education, but all of the white people who went to school every day, who got their mamas to drop them off, they never had to jump a ditch, right? Mm-hmm. They didn't even have to wake up in the morning and look out of the window and said, is the rain preventing me from going to school today?
Yeah.
And you're saying we need more role models and not bridges, right?
Yeah.
And that's the point, right? Like, if you don't have to jump a ditch, how the hell you know what these people need? And that was always my point.
I think is your brilliance, right? That you are able to take really relatable things and use them to help black people understand what's going on and to call a spade a spade. Because Pete Buttigieg was lying for sure. tell me this. One of the other things that I love about your writing is black people are always the heroes. Black people are always at the center. Tell me about that.
Yeah, I think that's part of like just growing up in a black family in a black neighborhood and being homeschooled. And like when I was writing Black AF History, I actually interviewed my mom because I never actually knew why we were homeschooled. Uh-huh. Right. And so she told me a quote that I'll never forget. She said, I did not believe that a black child's humanity can be fully realized in the presence of whiteness. Uh-huh. And so, you know, I understand that looking back, how she saw that. But, you know, in the world that we live in, like we often forget just how we are seen and, you know, how this world is constructed and we have to cater to it, right? Like, I think one of the things that I never learned is how to talk to white people. Like, you know, I think we all kind of cater to whiteness in this subconscious way where we're careful not to make them mad and we construct our language to have it approachable and acceptable for them. And I never learned how to do that. So I think that's you know, one of the things that I think just, I don't look at it as centering blackness. I think of it as centering myself as a human in my own humanity. And like everything else, right, that doesn't comport with that must be the enemy.
That is powerful. One more question about the book, and then I want to talk a little bit about some of the other work that you do. You have questions at the end of every section, and then there's a homework chapter at the end. What's up with that?
Yeah, so the idea was to write the book as not just a straightforward history book, right? But to have fun with it, to have questions and tests and to expose, you know, what in the book, one of the things that the book does, right, is expose how we learn, right? Like there's a subtle thing that I do in the book where, for instance, if I talk about a person who was enslaved, out of Angola, I will call them an Angolan, not a slave, not an African American, but an Angolan. Mm-hmm. And all the white people were just white people, right? Because
yes.
And what I was doing, right, is when you say English, when you say a pilgrim, when you say a Spanish person, that automatically imbues that person with a history, a political yes. motivation. Like, you know, like when I say the pilgrims, you know, these are people from England who moved to Germany, who escaped religious persecution. You know their religion. Yeah. You know what yep. they believe in. And when you say Africa, you don't know anything. You don't know where they come geographically, right? You don't know where what their religion was. You don't know what their lineage was. And so the thing I did with the book and the thing that I did with those questions at the end is to show the absurdity of the American education system as it relates to Black people, right? Right? You know, the questions of, like, there are, for instance, you know, terms. And for instance, I ask, you know, what is the difference between a settler and an invader? And the difference is who writes the police report. Right. And it seems funny, but it is also an example of how, for instance, we know that the SAT is culturally biased, right? Because of the way they ask the questions. Right. Right. And we've learned things like that. Well, we know. Actually, the SAT was not just like accidentally culturally biased. It was created to keep non-white people out of universities. But we won't get into that. But that was the point of the book, right? To expose the other people. Because you can't say, like, if you get mad at me saying white people, then you got to also be mad at all of the teachers who say the Africans or the Indians slaves. Or the Native Americans without or who renamed all of those indigenous people to words that'll fit in white people's mouths, right? Like, you got to be mad at all of that.
Indeed. Indeed. So in addition to writing books, you are a prolific podcaster. What is Drapetomania, and why is that the name of your podcast?
So, Drapetomaniacs, in 1852, this actual doctor named Samuel Adolphus Cartwright came up with this medical theory that was in books for like the next 60, 70 years. And he came up with a disease called Drapetomania, the disease causing slaves, causing Black people to want to be free. Right. It only affected Black people. There was this disease that made Black people want to be free. And it was a medical diagnosis. Even like you can look in newspapers even after, you know, the 1910s and the 1920s, and they would call like Black activists drapetomaniacs, or they were affected by drapetomania. Even the FBI, like that was the origin of COINTELPRO. Like there was like the word drapetomania. So I took that word and wondered, like, if that was actually a disease, who would be the worst drapetomaniacs, like Ida B. Wells? And so what the podcast did was we got celebrities and people you know from the culture to do these funny, each episode was a different story with these celebrities acting the parts of these Black stories from history about drapetomaniacs, and each one was its own genre. So, for instance, we did Ida B. Wells versus Booker T. Washington as a battle rapper, right? We did the story of an 1811 slave revolt as if it was an episode of the first 48. We did the candidates who were candidates for the title of the first African American. This is a century before 1619, the people who were in America. And we had a game show and each of them told their stories and the audience got to judge. So it was fun. We had people like, Pharrell, John Legend,
Rolling
just say
Martin,
yeah,
yeah,
like,
yeah,
Joy Reid say, I'll do that, right? And we told these stories in the funniest, a lot of them were untold stories in the funniest and most entertaining way with this podcast.
If you have not listened to Drapedomaniacs, you should absolutely get it wherever you get your podcast. So you're a podcaster. You are the Black Dean of Twitter. Are you still on Twitter?
I tweet out. I use a service that tweets out my articles on Twitter, but I don't be on it like that. It's just not fun no more.
We out. Okay. But you've also written books. You've written curricula. What haven't you done? What do you want to do that you haven't done yet?
I want to write everything in every genre. So, I want to write a narrative movie. I've written for docs, and I've been in docs, but I want to do a narrative movie. I've written for late night TV, but I hadn't written for a TV series. I want to do that. So every form of writing, I think of myself first and foremost as a writer, and I want to explore every aspect of that. And you know, it sounds kind of self-important, but I think it's cool to want to be, when I am gone from this earth, to have all of these things in every genre represent me. And maybe somebody will say, that dude could write.
Huh. I love that. I absolutely love that. And I appreciate that, because one of my questions was going to be, what do you want when you get to the pearly gates? What do you want people to say about you? But there we are. That dude could write. So like everybody else in America, our listeners are trying to survive and thrive during maybe what might be the greatest political upheaval, at least in recent history. What message do you have for them to help them remain hopeful and to keep fighting the good fight?
Well, I think that my thing that I always say is that, first of all, what we're seeing now is a part of a centuries-long effort that never stopped, right? It's nothing new. It is something, it's a continuum, it's part of a continuum. But here's the thing about that continuum. If you think of everything that has been done to human beings, there's nothing that has ever been done to a human being that hasn't been done to Black people en masse. And we are undefeated. What do you think? We beat slavery. We beat Jim Crow. We beat, all of that stuff. We beat the Red Summer. We beat it all. Not only did we, we like to say we survived, but now we didn't just survive. We were the ones who ended it. Right. We were the ones who made this country a democracy. We were the ones who created the American education system. And we did it with nothing. Right. So the thing that always gives me hope, especially with what we're seeing now, is, and I don't even like to categorize it as Black people magic or have this superpower. The truth is, the people who are trying to stop us have been historically incompetent at stopping Black people. They are terrible at doing things, right? When you think about it, right? So think about if you have more people, more money, more power, more land, and you still can't stop the enslaved people from unenslaving themselves. If you still can't stop the people from building their own education systems and creating their own communities and becoming doctors and lawyers and being better at all of it than you are, right? Mm-hmm. You really kind of incompetent, and we see it played out right now. They put in who they think is the smartest man in the world in charge of the government, and he can't do nothing. He's pushing the Black people out the smartest man in the world, and he can't do what they do. Like, everything's falling apart, right? Because he can't do, like, he got all the white people who's supposedly smart, and the planes falling out of the sky, and the computers don't work, and all of that. Like he had, he used all of his millions to buy this platform that, and everybody's leaving it because the black people made it fun. The black people made it interesting. And yeah, ultimately, here is what the thing that gives me comfort, right? Black people and black culture and the thing that we have built is a form of wealth that is more valuable than all of the money and all of the stock that Elon Musk holds. Just think about it, right? When Elon Musk bought Twitter, it was black Twitter that made it valuable. And when black people started leaving it, everybody started leaving, right? When the biggest record company in the world had the two most famous artists in the world and they got to the top of their careers, how? Well, they just went into their houses and made music and just give it directly to the people. The white companies didn't have anything to do with that, right? When the largest retailers in the world saw black people out in the streets, they got so scared they put it in DEI, and now that stock is tanking because they took it out. Like, our culture and the value that we bring to everything is worth more than all of their money. And I think that we should think of that every time you go into a store and buy something. We should think of it as, what are you investing in? What, like, you're the millionaire. We are millionaires. We're billionaires. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What are we going to invest in, though? Are we going to invest our money into these people who want to exclude us? And I think as their world falls apart, we know we're going to survive. Mm-hmm. But what are we going to build in the meantime? As that stuff falls apart, we have the opportunity to build and invest. And that is the opportunity that we rarely see.
Michael Harriet, oh my gosh, you just set this whole interview on fire. I want to say thank you so, so much for your wisdom, for your wit, and for the work that you are doing to help us all get free. Pod Save the People family, this has been amazing. A bit of a dream come true for me. I'm totally fangirling. And I'm appreciative that the Blackest Book Club gives us the opportunity to meet our heroes like Michael Harriet. And so if you want to join the conversation, check out recon.today/blackest-book-club, because we are seeking liberation through literature. Michael, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
We'd love you to come back sometime.
I'd love to come back. So thank you for having me.
Well, that's it. Thanks so much for tuning in to Pod Save the People this week. Don't forget to follow us at Cricket Media on Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok. And if you enjoyed this episode of Pod Save the People, consider dropping us a review on your favorite podcast app. And we'll see you next week. Pod Save the People is a production of Cricket Media. It's produced by AJ Moultrie and mixed by Vasilis Futopoulos. Executive produced by me, and special thanks to our weekly contributors, Kai Henderson, DR Ballinger, and Miles E. Johnson.
Our production staff is proudly unionized with the Writers Guild of America East.